moving under a bridge spanning a river.
In 1888, in Provence, in the city of Arles, an event occurred that would enter modern legend. In the red light district on the northern edge of town, a foreigner arrived at the door of a brothel. He handed a package to one of the girls. That package contained a bloody piece of his own flesh. The man's name was Vincent van Gogh. At the time, he was an unknown and unsuccessful painter. But today, he's among the most celebrated artists of all time. That year in Arles has gone on to define him. The year he created his most treasured masterpieces, but also the time when he took a knife to his own ear.
Vincent van Gogh was found in his bed at 7 in the morning on Christmas Eve, 1888. He was curled up in a fetal position, his head swathed in blood-soaked rags. The policeman who found him thought that he was dead.
It's the most famous incident in the history of modern art. But no one can agree what actually happened. We can't even be sure that he cut off his own ear. Now I'm joining one dedicated art lover living in Provence, who's been on a 7-year mission to uncover the forgotten truth behind the legend.
There is something seriously wrong here.
Hunting for every possible scrap of evidence.
Eventually you find this tiny little document here.
Oh my God, fathers.
And hidden clues in the paintings on an international journey that promises to solve the most perplexing art mystery of our times.
Oh mon Dieu, je l'ai trouvé. Oh my God, I found it.
The Mystery of Van Gogh's Ear, presented by Jeremy Paxman.
The ancient town of Arles sits on the northern edge of the Camargue, a Roman city only 20 miles from the Mediterranean coast. Vincent van Gogh arrived here in 1888, aged 35, an unsuccessful artist, escaping the sneers of Paris for a brighter and, as he thought, purer world down south. In April, he went to a bullfight.
In the town's Roman amphitheatre, a bullfighter teases a bull with his cloak.
Culturally, this town sits between France and Spain, famous as a romantic place of cowboys and gypsies, with its own language, culture, and colourful costumes. When Van Gogh painted the scene, he focused on the exotic women in the stands, not the gory action in the arena.
The crowd was magnificent, he wrote to a friend. The local women and girls in cheap, simple material in green or red or pink or Havana yellow. And above it all, a sulphurous sun in a vibrant blue sky. It was all, he said, as gay as Holland was dismal.
It's hard at first not to get swept away in the spectacle. But it's not a fair fight, and it has an inevitable end.
Jeremy looks uncomfortable as he watches.
For local people, the bloody end of these poor animals is the explanation for Vincent's own bloody episode in Arles.
There's a local yarn that says that Van Gogh's cutting off of his ear and sending it to his girlfriend is explained by bullfighting because at the end of a successful contest, the bull's ear is cut off and sent to a lucky recipient in the audience.
Unfortunately, the facts get in the way of this local legend. When Vincent was here, they didn't cut off the ears. That's a tradition they've imported from Spain.
And ears thrown to the crowd.
What happens here is, for the most part, impenetrable to outsiders. But the local story can't always be trusted. It's for that reason that Van Gogh's time here is so misunderstood.
A woman watering plants in a shady courtyard.
It would take a foreigner with local knowledge to help unravel the mystery.
My favourite part of the day is to water the plants.
Bernadette Murphy was once an art history student in London, but she moved to Provence back in 1983. After years living and working in the region, she knows the place and the people about as well as any outsider can.
Bernadette's driving through the countryside.
I'm a foreigner, fair enough, but there's also another term which they use here, un étranger. It means somebody who's not from their environment. So you'll always be probably an étranger in Provence, but slowly I'm pretty well integrated now.
Bernadette became fascinated by the stories told about Provence's most famous étranger, Vincent van Gogh. She was astonished to discover how little was known for sure about his story and the night he's said to have cut off his ear.
I kept thinking, aren't there police records? You know, aren't there medical records? How comes there's so much ambiguity about the whole story? And I thought, you know what? I'm going to look into this a little bit further. And so the adventure began.
A field of gently waving yellow sunflowers with the terracotta roofs of the ancient town beyond.
Since 2010, Bernadette has haunted the town record offices, libraries and archives of Arles.
She greets a man in an office with a kiss on each cheek.
Her great advantage was that she had local knowledge and connections, and she knew her way around French bureaucracy.
So Robert, et puis le troisième.
Her first instinct was to understand the scene of the crime, the place where Vincent supposedly cut off his ear, and, incidentally, the most famous artist studio of all time.
A sketch of buildings morphs into a painting, then a black and white photo.
The Yellow House was both the inspiration for some of Van Gogh's most memorable paintings and the studio where many of his masterpieces were painted.
Arles from the air.
It was on the northern edge of the city, on Place Lamartine, until 1944, when it was bombed in the war.
Jeremy and Bernadette cross a street.
I met Bernadette where it once stood, to get my first feel for the place that was the centre of Van Gogh's world for 9 months in Arles. And the place where this whole brilliant and gruesome story played out.
Van Gogh's superimposed painting fades away.
You're actually standing more or less on the site of the Yellow House. This part of the Yellow House was the entry doorway. And the Yellow House wasn't flat at the front, it was sort of slightly triangular. So over this way, this would be part of the studio, and above my head was Vincent's bedroom.
But that building there is very recognisable from the painting, isn't it?
It's the only one, really, that still exists.
And how did Vincent van Gogh end up living here?
He arrived in Arles, the station was over there, and he walked through the gates that are over there, through into the city, and took a room in a hotel. Meanwhile, we know that he's painting in the fields beyond the station. And on the way, he had to pass in front of a cafe, and the cafe was over there. And the lady who ran it, she'd been raised in the Yellow House, and her parents both died there. So the house had not been lived in for about 18 months when Vincent took it over.
Vincent's painting gives a vivid sense of Place Lamartine as he knew it. In the background is the railway bridge leading to the station. In the foreground, roadworks where the gas main was being installed. And in the streets, his neighbours mill about on their way to and from the greengrocer. It's an image bursting with optimism. And yet it was behind those pretty green windows that he supposedly cut his own ear. How did Van Gogh's life in Arles go so very badly wrong?
The town at night.
The mystery all turns on events two nights before Christmas 1888. The bare facts are reported in local press accounts. At 11:30, a man named Monsieur Vincent appeared at the door of a brothel on Rue de Boudal. He asked there for a girl named Rachel. When she arrived, he handed her his own severed ear. But can the reports really be trusted? More than one account gives his nationality not as Dutch, but as Polish. Three versions say the ear was in a package. Another says he was holding it in place on his head. Most say this girl Rachel was a prostitute. But one says she was just a girl who worked at a cafe.
The amphitheatre floodlit at night.
With so many inconsistencies, Bernadette was determined to find out what, if anything, was true, even the fact that he'd cut off his ear.
A self-portrait.
It's the one thing we think we all know about Vincent, but is it really just tabloid sensationalism? Because the world's foremost experts aren't convinced that's what actually happened.
Cyclists pedaling along a road and bicycles chained to railings on a bridge over a canal.
In Amsterdam is the beating heart of the world of Van Gogh. The Van Gogh Museum, founded by his descendants.
Bernadette walking past the museum.
This magnificent museum holds the world's largest collection of his paintings, and it's visited by nearly 2 million people a year.
Someone closely inspecting a painting.
It's regularly asked to adjudicate upon amateur theories on Vincent.
We're a museum about a very famous artist. And many people are always obsessive about the artist in the sense that they tend to think that they've got a personal relationship with him. And I have to tell you that there are many, well, I call them amateur historians, who are interested in questions of Van Gogh and tries to solve them by themselves. And Bernadette is such a person.
Bernadette has been given access to the museum's own research centre.
Great, great, thank you.
She has asked to see the evidence which seems to cast doubt on the story that he cut off his ear. This notebook of an early biographer contains a letter from the painter Paul Signac, who visited Vincent shortly after his injury.
So it says, I saw him the last time in Arles in the spring of 1889. He was already at the hospital of the town. But the day of my visit, he was perfectly okay, and he had the famous band round his head and a fur hat. A few days earlier, he had cut off the lobe of the ear and not the ear.
Seeming to support this is a drawing that was made of Vincent on his deathbed a year and a half later by his doctor.
And there's Vincent lying with his eyes shut and the ear, the top part of the ear, perfectly intact. So this confirms what Paul Signac said in 1921, an eyewitness statement and another eyewitness statement. So there is something seriously wrong here. That a man would cut the lobe of an ear and it would become the most famous incident associated with any artist ever. I'm a little bit underwhelmed. It's a bit surprising.
The newspapers all say that he cut off his ear, but these later eyewitnesses are clear it was only the lobe. Experts have long been perplexed by this disparity.
Who to believe? That's always been the question. But in general, for us, what we chose, what we found the more reliable, is some of these people who were close to him, who saw him, who knew him for a couple of times and who saw him, and they said it was half the year. So that has always been our point of view.
Theo Meydendorp, senior researcher.
Was the ear incident a major crisis? Or was it just a minor event that's been sexed up over time?
A busy art gallery where one of the visitors is studying a self-portrait of Van Gogh.
Unlike the vast majority of other artists, Vincent's life is as famous as his work. It's one of the reasons this museum in particular is so well attended. Of course, Van Gogh isn't the only artist who could pack out a gallery day after day, but what is unusual about him is the extent to which his personal story is tied up in our appreciation of his paintings. People don't just come to see the sunflowers, they want to see the self-portraits, the staring eyes of a man dead at 37, whose vision was simply too intense for the world. For once, the word icon is the right one. These images stand for the modern belief that genius and self-destruction go hand in hand. So, if he didn't cut his ear off, is that whole story built on a lie?
Self-portraits.
The man who arrived in Arles was 35 years old and had plenty in his background to suggest a tortured soul.
Photographs.
Born in 1853, the son of a Dutch Protestant minister, those close to him long suspected he might be mentally ill. He was unable to sustain careers as an art dealer, a pastor, or as a teaching assistant. Instead of respectable relationships, he was drawn to peasants and poor street women, the only people who would put up with his weird, fanatical personality.
Stephen Nafee, biographer.
You have a person who is alternately unbelievably depressive or unbelievably manic, who and also attached himself to people. If he found a friend, he wouldn't let that person go. But he was also terribly argumentative. So that left him literally in a life with almost no friendship and with a family that despaired over him. There were times in his life when he was so lonely that the only person he spoke to during the day was the waitress at the cafe who he ordered his lunch from. So a few of us can imagine the sheer agony of being Vincent van Gogh.
Vincent's gaze.
The one person who stuck by him throughout was his younger brother, Theo. Theo was a successful art dealer, and it was he who took up the burden of setting Vincent back on the straight and narrow by offering to fund a new career for him as a painter. But he was unable to sell any of Vincent's dour early work. In February 1888, Vincent was a failed painter, totally dependent on his brother, and suspected by many of being mentally ill. That seems easily enough to explain a nervous breakdown.
A blown-up image of Vincent on the wall.
But actually, the year it happened, things were all going pretty well.
Purple flowers on long green stems blowing in the breeze. A farm building with a red tile roof, then a field of sunflowers. the sunflowers nodding in the wind with their vibrant yellow petals and darker heads.
On February the 20th, he moved down to Arles, and there he took off on daily treks into the countryside in search of inspiration for a new kind of art.
When you think of the heat and the fact that he was carrying an easel and canvases, these walks must have been real marathons. What seduced him were the colours. He had abandoned completely the dreary old greys and browns of northern Europe, and here in southern France seemed to have discovered an entirely new world.
To us, the landscape around Arles is quintessential Provence. But in Vincent's mind, it was dazzlingly alien. But whether it was the rich colours that surrounded him, or simply the fact that he was away from critical eyes, on these lonely country walks, he finally found his painting style.
When he got where he wanted to be, he attacked the canvas. "I follow no recognized system of brushwork," he said. "I hit with irregular brush strokes, which I leave as they are. I'm tempted to think that the results will be so worrying and annoying as not to please people with preconceived ideas about technique."
A painting of trees.
He was right. No one understood it at the time. But now we see his works in Arles as his masterpieces.
Views of Van Gogh's Café Terrace on the Place du Forum, Arles, at night, then of sunflowers.
He wrote to Theo that he'd found the future of modern art. And he dreamed that a whole movement of artists would soon join him on a shared mission, painting in the south.
Flying over the idyllic countryside. A self-portrait with a turquoise background.
But what was it that changed Vincent from this optimistic dreamer into a mental patient capable of self-harm? Bernadette is convinced the answers have to lie in the town of Arles itself.
An aerial view of tiled roofs at night time. White facades and towers dominating the skyline.
She took me to the last place Vincent was seen the night he cut his ear. The Rue du Boudal, only 100 yards from the Yellow House. He was seen there at a brothel at about 11:30 p.m.
Well, this was the heart of the red light district in Arles in 1888.
So these were all brothels, were they?
Well, unfortunately, this was a convent, and they complained incessantly about the noise. But, of course, the town fathers ignored that quite happily.
What was it like on the street down here, then?
I would imagine a pretty lively place. This whole street would have been comings and goings and quite a lot of noise. People were making complaints and saying the girls were making lewd remarks, and there was screaming and yelling and all sorts of things going on.
But we know that Van Gogh was a frequent user of brothels, do we?
Well, he and his brother talk about it quite openly in their letters. You know, it was part and parcel of life, I think, of a 19th century man. You just went to the brothel, and Vincent equates it with, you know, having bread and food. I've got enough money for this. I haven't had a screw for 3 weeks. You know, he actually says that.
They walk on.
Vincent frequented many of these brothels, and he painted one, giving us a sense of the atmosphere. But on the night of December the 23rd, he sought out one in particular.
He crossed over the square.
It's been identified at the end of the street.
And he came directly to this house, which was the House of Tolerance number one.
That's what, somewhere around here, is it?
It's actually here.
Where these cars are parked.
It was absolutely here where these cars were parked. It was bombed by accident in the Second World War.
What do we know about what happened? I mean, he knocked on the door, and what happened then?
Well, around 11:30, he turned up here, but he doesn't seem to go into the brothel. He asks for this girl called Rachel. At least that's what the local newspaper says. And presumably she came out into the street, and he hands her a parcel. And he gives it to her and says something that seems almost biblical in reference. He says, take care of this, look after this, carefully do this. Keep a souvenir of me, a memory of me.
Do this in remembrance of
That's
me.
That's what I think, yeah, you see. Yeah. It's not something just done arbitrarily. It's done as a gift for her.
What was going on here? Was Vincent, in his madness, trying to seduce this poor girl? Was he trying to scare her? Most intriguingly, he knows her. He asks for her by name. If we can find out who she was, maybe we can work out what he was doing and thereby understand the act itself a little better.
In an archive room.
For Bernadette, this kicked off the search for Rachel. A search in its way as intriguing as the question about his ear.
So, I know that the prostitutes were all based in a particular part of town, which is Section E.
In 19th century France, brothels were regulated by the state. They were called houses of tolerance. The prostitutes and the madams were recorded in the town census with delicate euphemisms for their jobs.
Well, a limonadier is just a term that they use to describe somebody who was running a brothel. It could also be somebody who actually did sell lemonade, so you have to be a little bit careful about judging people like that, limonadier. So I have to look for limonadier and I have to look for a fille soumise. A fille soumise means a girl under the thumb, a submissive woman, literally, a girl under the thumb, and that's what you call prostitutes. So if we go down, look at the ages, they're a little bit older than one would imagine, 26, 29, 25, 30, 30, 28. They're not young women.
Each of these names stands for a woman Vincent might have visited. Officially registered prostitutes, strictly over 21, whose ages and health status were all recorded by the state. But Bernadette can't find Rachel, the one girl she's looking for.
When I look at all the girls who are indicated as fille soumise, they've got lots of names, Jeanne, Rose, Marguerite, Marie, Madeleine. But there are no Rachels here whatsoever.
Now looking through more records.
Bernadette spent months trying to get to the bottom of this question. Why were there no Rachels in the town census? Then a clue emerged which completely changed everything. She revisited an old press article quoting the policeman who attended the scene of the crime. In it, he says, the prostitute's name escapes me, though her working name was Gabby. For Bernadette, there came a moment of realization. Rachel is a highly unusual name in Arles. She went back to the records and found a document listing prostitutes. Many of the names were followed by the words dite Rachel, called Rachel.
It's not their real name. It's just the nickname. You know, they have other names like Blondie and Redhead and silly things like that, but Rachel is one of the names that occurs linked into different girls. So maybe, although Policeman Robert said Gabby was her working name, maybe he just got it wrong. Maybe it was her real name.
There were no Rachels living in Arles in 1888, but there were 31 women called Gabrielle or Gabby. One of those women must have been the girl Vincent gave his ear to.
Period photographs of everyday life in the city.
If we can learn her identity, we may be able to understand what led him to give her his ear, or part of it. But there's another crucial character in this story who's far easier to track down. In the weeks before he cut his ear, Vincent had been living cheek by jowl with another great post-impressionist, the notorious Paul Gauguin.
Gauguin was a very complicated and interesting painter, and a very great one, but he was sort of a jerk. He had a very high opinion of himself, but he also must have been terribly charismatic, because not only did he draw women to him, but he also drew acolytes.
Jeremy's on foot.
One of his admirers was Vincent van Gogh. Gauguin was the man he went to first when Vincent hit upon a plan to reinvent the Yellow House as an artist's studio or brotherhood. They lived there in a sort of commune or a medieval guild, or as he put it, like a band of Japanese Buddhist monks, and his art dealer brother Theo would feed them and clothe them and give them canvases and paint, and the artists would just create. Vincent spent weeks writing to Gauguin, persuading him to join him in his utopian idea. The sunflowers were painted to decorate Gauguin's bedroom. He bought 12 wicker chairs for the brother artists, and one ornate chair for Gauguin himself, whose age and success meant he would be the father superior in their community. But the real Gauguin couldn't have been more different to Vincent's monkish ideal. A canny ex-banker, self-publicist, and serial adulterer.
He arrives in Arles, this ladies' man who has a pretty strong ego, and he finds himself in this house with this very difficult person with almost no self-esteem, who doesn't believe he can possibly find a woman to sleep with without paying her, and it's a terrible situation. He's only there because Theo is paying him to be there, and almost within days of arrival, he's sending his friends back in Paris letters saying, I gotta get out of here. I can't possibly take this any longer.
Van Gogh's dream of brotherhood was doomed from the start. Not only did he and Gauguin have different personalities, they disagreed about art.
Vincent's piercing stare.
Gauguin liked to paint from his imagination. He found laughable Vincent's habit of painting from life. He produced what seems a mocking portrait of Vincent painting the sunflowers. Vincent looked at it and said, "That's me, all right, but me gone mad." According to Gauguin, there's a sequel to this story.
After he had shown Van Gogh the painting, the two of them went to a bar where Van Gogh ordered a glass of absinthe. He then threw the absinthe and the glass at Gauguin. Gauguin ducked, it smashed on the wall, and he helped Van Gogh home and put him to bed. The next morning, Van Gogh woke up, saying, "My dear Gauguin, I have a dim recollection that I fear I may have offended you last night."
Vincent's dreams of artistic fraternity were turning into nightmares, and he was losing control of his fragile mental health. All was not well inside the Yellow House.
A painting of the building. A sunny day in the historic city.
In Arles, Bernadette is still trying to establish the identity of the girl called Gabrielle, we're told Vincent gave his ear to. The search has hit multiple dead ends and frustrations. until a friend passed her a copy of a little-known book on Van Gogh, which contained one crucial nugget of local knowledge about Gabby.
Towards the end of the book, there are just four little lines, but for me they're really exciting. It says Rachel, who was called Gabby, died in 1952 at the age of 80. So what I have to do is find out if it really is true, whether I can find anybody called Gabby who died around the age of 80 in 1952.
This information completely changes the search because only one person called Gabrielle died in Arles in 1952. But that person was a 19-year-old girl in 1888. In other words, 2 years too young legally to be a prostitute. Was that girl Gabby? If so, this'll be a sensitive issue because her descendants still live just outside Arles.
So I think I've really got to go and see the family now. It's not going to be an easy one, though, because I've got to talk to them and ask somebody if their family had a prostitute in the family.
The family live out of town in a small village. If they confirm Gabby's identity, then we may finally understand what Vincent was doing at the brothel that night. But this is a secretive place. Bernadette met them the first time off camera, and that cagey meeting was full of revelation.
A farm worker in a field.
So we travelled there again, in the hope of an interview.
Jeremy waits in the car.
But ultimately, they refuse to be filmed or named. It's understandable because what they had to say was so sensitive.
The man looked at me and said, oh, Rachel's my great-grandmother.
It's a really dark family secret.
Well, it's only a dark family secret if she was a prostitute, and that's the whole problem. Was she or was she not?
The family confirmed their ancestor, Gabrielle, was the girl who's always been called Rachel. But their stories only added to the doubts Bernadette had about her profession.
Her age was not quite right. She married soon afterwards. It just didn't tie in with her being a prostitute. And the story only began to fall into place when I began to realise that she never was.
What was she doing at the brothel then?
She was a cleaner. In the archives, you find lists of cooks, cleaners. She was too young to be a prostitute. And that, I think, is why Vincent van Gogh actually met her in the street. That's why he didn't go into the brothel that night.
But that's no cause for shame, is it? I mean, she was just a femme de ménage, a cleaner or...
Yeah. She was just a small, little, meek working girl.
This turns the traditional story on its head. Bernadette has seen evidence that not only was Gabby a cleaner at the brothel, she also worked at more than one of Vincent's favourite haunts on Place Lamartine. She wasn't his prostitute. She must have been a friend he saw every day. We're now closer than ever before to a true picture of what drove Vincent the night he cut his ear. And there's also evidence in the paintings for what was really on his mind.
A woman wearing blue gloves unscrews a protective covering from a painting.
The Kruller Muller Museum, in the heart of the Dutch countryside, has brought out for inspection one little-known canvas by Van Gogh. It's a painting he produced in the immediate aftermath of the night he cut his ear. and it has proved a mine of clues for experts as to Vincent's state of mind that night.
Marika, what do we know about this painting?
We know it's one of the first paintings that Van Gogh made after getting back home when he was in the hospital, on which he just arranged a still life with onions in the middle and a bottle, a coffee pot.
This is a medical book, isn't it?
It's a medical book for home use.
This is a painting of the objects Vincent's mind dwelt upon as he tried to come to terms with what he'd done. Research has focused on the letter in the bottom right-hand corner, which we now know he received the very morning of the incident. A message from his brother.
We know that because his handwriting is discernible. We also know that the envelope was stamped 67, and that's the number of the post office where his brother went to, near his apartment in Paris. And then there is a franking mark here saying Jour de l'An, and it was used during Christmas and New Year. So that's how we know that it must have been sent end of December.
Do we know what was in the envelope?
There's a theory that this is the actual letter in which his brother announces his engagement to Jo Bonger.
And why would that upset him?
Well, Theo, to him, was his dearest friend. He supported him emotionally and financially. He sent him about 100 francs a month. So he might have been afraid of losing that, and it might have contributed to his mental breakdown.
On December the 21st, 1888, Vincent's brother Theo became engaged to his fiancée, Joanna. Van Gogh received the news on December the 23rd, the same day Gauguin told him he was leaving. Was this the moment Vincent lost his grip on reality? In the Yellow House, did his mind teem with thoughts of his brother's happiness and Gauguin's betrayal? Gauguin himself later recorded Vincent's erratic conversation.
A disruption of images, a self-portrait, Pearl at Night, Purple Petals.
Gothic novels were mentioned with a hero stalked by madness. He dwelt on the murders of prostitutes being reported in the papers and the betrayal of Christ in the Garden of Gethsemane when St. Peter the disciple cut off a centurion's ear. He was so bizarre that I couldn't take it, Gauguin wrote later. He even said to me, "Are you going to leave?" And when I said yes, he tore this sentence from a newspaper and put it in my hand. It said, "The murderer took flight." Horrified, Gauguin left to spend the night in a hotel, leaving Vincent alone with his demons.
The painting of the Yellow House.
What happened next has remained a complete mystery. But evidence was to emerge from the last place you'd expect.
A clip from a biopic of Van Gogh.
In 1956, MGM Pictures released Lust for Life, starring an Oscar-nominated Kirk Douglas as Vincent Van Gogh. Its overblown score and dramatic performances cemented in our minds the Van Gogh of legend, slicing off his ear in a fit of madness. Experts have long since dismissed this version as histrionic. But ironically, this scene led Bernadette to a clue that ended up being crucial.
Vincent's cut off his ear.
Deep in the Van Gogh Museum archives, she found a letter in an old magazine about Lust for Life. It explains how Irving Stone, the writer behind the film, did his research into the ear.
This is a letter that's dated 1955, I'd originally rejected it because it was so recent, and it's a reply to a man who had questioned Time magazine, who had done an article on Vincent van Gogh and talked about him having cut off his whole ear. This man had written and said, no, he only cut off the lobe. Everybody knows that, Paul Signac said. So, and this is from the editorial offices, and it says, when Irving Stone, the author of Lust for Life, was in Arles, he visited Dr. Felix Rey. Dr. Rey was the only man still alive who had seen Vincent van Gogh without his ear. But then it says something extraordinarily interesting. It says Dr. Rey drew a medical diagram for Irving Stone, which he later signed and which Mr. Stone now has in his possession. It's dated 1955. So what I need to know is Felix Rey's medical diagram still somewhere?
Felix Rey was the doctor who treated Vincent's injury throughout his time in the hospital. More than that, the two became friends and Vincent painted him. There could be no better witness to what happened to Vincent van Gogh's ear. And somewhere, there's a document he gave to Hollywood writer Irving Stone answering exactly that question.
Bernadette's making notes.
The Irving Stone archive is kept in Berkeley, California.
The iconic Golden Gate Bridge, with traffic travelling its span.
For Bernadette, this meant a journey across the world to San Francisco Bay.
A group of drummers.
She's been emailing Berkeley's archivist David Kessler, trying to track down Felix Rey's elusive drawing.
This was sort of a ping pong that went over a couple of days of me saying, can you try this box? How about this? What about this? And him saying, well, I haven't really got anything like that. After my fifth question, I said, do you think you could just look one more time? And I went to bed that night. And I woke up the next morning and there was an email in my inbox, you know, having mailed him all day long. And he said in French, oh mon Dieu, je l'ai trouvé. Oh my God, I found it.
Now, finally, Bernadette is on her way to meet the man she's been corresponding with. And to see the document he says he's found.
He discarded stuff as he went along, so only a very few things exist. So all of it fits in this box 91 of the collection. And in this, one of the things I finally found was a little document in the first folder, which demonstrates what you've been looking for, I think, which is what happened with the ear. And if you go through here, eventually you find this tiny little document here.
Oh, my God, fathers.
And it's from Dr. Ray Felix.
Jack, I'm going to lose. I'm sorry. I work so hard on this. I can't believe it. I can't believe it. After all these years, I'm so sorry.
It's just a thin little tiny piece of paper here. And so much is so eloquent in its own way.
Delicately, Bernadette removes the piece of paper from its cover. It includes the doctor's address and a drawing of an ear.
This is from Dr. Felix Rey. I can definitely say that's his signature. It's dated the 18th of August, 1930. And it's unbelievable. It's a before and after drawing, you know. And it says, I am so happy to be able to give you some information that you asked me concerning my unhappy friend, Van Gogh. I do hope that you glorify the genius of this remarkable painter. Cordially yours, Dr. Rey. And basically, it's a drawing of an ear, and there's a dotted line, and it says the ear was cut with a razor following the dotted line and the aspect that is left of the lobe of the ear.
That's what it looked like afterwards. So it really documents that he removed his whole ear. It must have been an incredibly painful thing to do, and it's what was going through his mind at that time must have been really remarkable.
Well, I've been working, I think, as you know, on this for some time, and you just, when you finally get to see something, you realise what a really gruesome thing happened. It brings home the violence of the act.
The image with the dotted line down the length of the ear. Canal boats and cyclists. Bernadette's crossing a bridge.
Now in Amsterdam, Bernadette has brought a copy of the document for verification by the Van Gogh Museum. Has she found the proof that eluded all the experts that Van Gogh did cut off his whole ear?
This is what I found in Berkeley.
The museum have deployed Theo Meedendorp and Louis van Tilborg to see if this gains their seal of approval.
Theo.
This is amazing. It's quite clear on what happened. So only a tiny piece of the lobe.
Yeah, remains. There's no ambiguity.
No, absolutely not.
Evidently, we wanted to make it clear by making two drawings.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So
yeah.
We didn't want
the
point to be missed.
Yeah.
I mean,
I couldn't have dreamt of finding anything so crazy, really.
Well, this stands the received wisdom on the head, doesn't it?
It makes it very clear. I mean, now you finally got a document of the person who saw him immediately after it happened.
Who treated him.
Treated him and said that, that was a whole ear, and there's no reason now more to doubt about that.
That's the information that he got from Ray. So he only could have got it from Ray, so that's makes quite original, I would say.
New evidence of Van Gogh is a rare commodity, let alone the final proof that he did cut off his ear. The museum has already begun negotiations for the document to star in a major new exhibition. It's an unprecedented achievement for an amateur researcher.
It was really very thrilling. Very thrilling. And there's kind of something quite special about finding something new about someone who's so famous. When you find something like that and you think, well, nothing's going to come of it. Is it really real? To have them say that it's the definitive answer to the question, my heart was beating.
Not many of us can say we've contributed to history, really.
I suppose you have.
I suppose I have. How funny. It is, it's great fun.
But when the excitement dies down, you're left with a story that's deeply unsettling. Not just a cliche, a piece of art trivia, but a harrowing moment for a desperate man. People make jokes about Van Gogh's ear, but really, what happened that night in the Yellow House was pretty disturbing. There he was, alone, surrounded by all these amazing paintings which he couldn't sell. He thought about his life, he took a cutthroat razor, and he cut his ear from top to bottom. He severed the artery behind his ear, and rags were found later that he'd used to try to stem the flow of blood. But instead of calling a doctor, he hid the wound under a hat and made preparations to go out. He wrapped up the severed ear in newspaper and headed out to a brothel. That is the last piece of the jigsaw. Why did he do it? Why did he take his ear to Gabrielle at the brothel? There's one last fascinating twist to this story. Before Vincent came to Arles, he was living in Paris. And Bernadette has discovered that Gabby, the brothel cleaner, was there at the same time.
So this was the site of the original Institut Pasteur.
She was sent here to the Institut Pasteur in January 1888 to be treated for a bite by a rabid dog.
I have a medical record here. As you can see, the name, her first name and her age, she was just 18, and she was bitten by a dog in Arles on the 8th of January around 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
The young Gabrielle received 20 injections over a period of 18 days. Then she went back to Arles. 3 weeks later, Vincent made the same journey.
Because he goes to Arles very shortly after this, doesn't he?
Yes, very shortly. I mean, it's literally...
Did they meet here and did Vincent follow Gabby down south?
I also have a letter.
Bernadette at first dismissed the thought, but then she found a letter Vincent wrote later that year which mentions poor girls treated for rabies in this very institution. He was, at the very least, intrigued and moved to pity by her injury.
So what do you think is the significance of this discovery?
Well, I think Vincent had... I was always attracted to people who were in difficulty or who wanted to help in some way. So the notion of taking the ear to this particular girl, a girl who had a visible scar, somebody who had suffered, she becomes another of his wounded angels that he wanted to help.
It's a tantalizing thought that Gabby could have been the reason Van Gogh went to Arles in the first place. But it also suggests a new interpretation of what Vincent was doing by giving her his ear. Vincent had always been drawn to unfortunate women and nurtured Christ-like fantasies of martyring himself for the poor. It looks as if in his distress he saw giving Gabby his ear as an act of religious self-sacrifice and compassion. Van Gogh would end his own life only 18 months later. But Gabby lived on till she was 82 years old.
From Sunflowers Nodding in a Wind to Jeremy in the Gallery.
This odyssey has transformed the whole debate about that night. This dangerous madman and this supposed prostitute have been shown for the real suffering people they were. And that presents a different picture of the man behind the canvas.
Knowing what happened that night, knowing the whole story, changes entirely how you see these paintings. They're no longer just familiar masterpieces, but you see them entirely afresh.
That brilliant but tragic year in Arles has left us with images that electrify the world. And now we can understand far better the story behind them. At the Van Gogh Museum, all the artworks and artifacts that led to these revelations are coming together. The confusing deathbed drawing, the still life with his brother's letter, the portrait he gave as a gift to Felix Rey. In a new exhibition, On the Verge of Insanity, that rewrites the legend of Vincent's descent into mental illness. And amidst the masterpieces, one tiny document forgotten by history that finally solves the mystery of Van Gogh's ear.
¶¶